Okay, great. Good morning, everyone. Very excited to be here. It's been a long day traveling yesterday, which means I'm totally jet-lagged, tired, a little bit phased out, but that makes me, I guess, all the more open and less inhibited to discuss what I'm going to tell you. But first of all, let me start by saying a big thank you to David, Tatjana, Misha, and Misha for putting together this awesome meeting, and of course also for inviting me to tell you a little bit about our work. So we are working on the retina, which is a rather small part of the brain, and giving this intimidating title of the entire workshop, recording and manipulating and so on from the entire brain, I feel a little bit obliged to explain a little bit maybe why I'm here, or how my work maybe relates to the context of this workshop. So this is my 2 minutes of general introduction, if you want a philosophical justification of why what we do on the retina relates to entire brain activity. So as a neurophysiologist, someone who's recording, measuring activity from nerve cells, the typical situation that we face is that we have a neuron that we record from, and then we relate it to something in the outside world, sensory stimulus or some motor pattern maybe, so let's say with a sensory stimulus. So we'll present some stimulus here, an abstract depiction of a stimulus, and measure the activity to that stimulus. And then we have other stimuli here depicted by other shapes, and we get different types of activity, but what we really would like to know is how this activity arises in this neuron, what causes this activity, presumably the way that it pools, gets input from its presynaptic neurons. So if we were able to record from the entire brain, which maybe in some model organisms we are at the moment, this would then be the excited stepping stone of relating activity here to activity here, and getting some idea about how computations, how signal processing works in the system. But in many systems, including the retina, we're not able yet to record from these presynaptic neurons or know these connections. And given that we are at an Institute of Theoretical Physics, and this is about combining computation and experiments, it may be justified to ask then computational tools, computational people, in order to help us with this connectivity, and maybe use the differences in the responses of these neurons to these stimuli to infer something about the presynaptic structure. So this is what we'll try to do, is to get some information about what presynaptic inputs go into this recorded neuron, so that by computational tools we can learn something about this connectivity here. And then if we can scale up the experimental methods and not only record from one neuron, but maybe from more neurons, from an entire layer of neurons, we can do this for this entire circuitry and infer maybe the entire presynaptic layer, and thereby learn something about maybe a small entire part of the brain, about the connectivity, the functional connectivity, shared connections, how many of these presynaptic neurons there are, and how they relate to the processing here in the downstream layer. So this is what I will talk about a little bit now with respect to the retina. What possibilities are there for doing such inference of neural circuitry? So in some sense, this will be a little bit of a methodological talk. But I think with interesting methods, and methods where, you know, nice and fun computation can be done, and where computational input can bring us a long way. In that sense, it will also be somewhat of a selfish talk, because I'm interested in using these techniques, and I'm also interested in asking you, maybe if you have ideas in the coming days, suggestions, or would like to try something out, we're willing to share data to maybe, you know, enforce these computational techniques. Okay, so we do this in the retina, which is a part of the brain, a neural circuit at the back of the eyeball. Most importantly, it's a neural network where signals are relayed from photoreceptors that take up light through a network of interneurons to ganglion cells, and these ganglion cells do make action potentials. They spike, and they are almost the only cells in the retina that make spikes, and therefore also the easiest to record from, where most of the data come from. Yet another reason to use computation to know something about the intrinsic structure here, because it's difficult to record from these neurons. When I talk about the retina in a computational setting, I often get the comment, why the retina? Isn't the retina solved already? Don't we know what it does? So honestly, who has a similar thought? I don't remember faces, so I'm not going to hold this against you. Okay, so there's some people do, other people don't dare to share their belief.
So I just have a question. I mean, why, maybe we can discuss this. I mean, at least superficially, you would think with an optical technique, or maybe the optical techniques aren't there yet. You could look at the entire, you know, look at the majority of cells in a two-dimensional sheet.
Mm-hmm.
Or a couple of layers in this two-dimensional sheet. Is that?
Yeah, this is coming up. So this has started recently or is starting now, that techniques and mechanisms or experimental recording techniques are there. The first thing that happens, right, I mean, apart from recording many ganglion cells, which I will also show you data from, the next step is then to record many of these bipolar cells that make the connections here between the, let's say, the layer where the photoreceptors are and the output layer of the retina. With the problems that with electrodes, it's difficult. With calcium imaging, it's difficult because the cells don't spike. They don't have the calcium signals. So the method of choice there was to use reporters of glutamate at the terminals of these cells. And that has worked in the lab of Thomas Euler. So as far as I know, at the moment, the only group that can do this. And they have recently reported about the diversity of signals that they see in sheets of bipolar cell terminals. So not yet enough to combine this, for example, with ganglion cell recordings. Yeah, I mean, yes and no. So first of all, I don't think it's a year or two from now. And then second, it comes from a different angle, right? So this inference would be an inference that specializes or is focused on functional interactions, right? To see how postsynaptic neuron is influenced or which neurons influences from a presynaptic structure. And that I would expect will be mostly complementary to, let's say, more standard techniques, let's say from connectomics that show you where potential connections are, because from these you don't easily see which ones are the functional relevant ones in a setting.
So this will not be, even if I would record from everything, I would still not know it's functional.
That would be my assumption, but of course it's hard to predict the future and see how far these experimental methods will go in, let's say, maybe 10 or 20 years rather than 1 or 2 years. Yeah, so even for those people, it's difficult. So people do it. So from individual bipolar cells, you can record by sticking electrodes in. People do that. We do that. Similar from photoreceptors, you can do this in slices or hole mounts. In a live animal, I've not seen that. And also in these retina and the dish preparations, this is where the glutamate imaging has been done in from many bipolar cells, or many bipolar cell terminals, one should say. Okay, there was another question here.
I'm wondering philosophically, you probably get to this, how do you deal with non-identifiability? Like when you're imputing a latent something,
mm-hmm.
there's always many ways that you could get that same latent showing up in your observations. So like, what's the actual goal there?
Maybe we'll see this more concretely later. So the goal that we will tackle to jump a little bit ahead is to infer from the activity patterns that we record in ganglion cells how many and where the bipolar cells are that provide input to this ganglion cell in a specific setting. Yes?
Okay, so every time you show this picture, you get the sense of translational invariance. So it suggests that you only need to look at a certain size. And yet some people talk about, you know, retinal ganglion cells that don't separate, an object from background or
mm-hmm.
So what's the lens scale? How much of the retina do you have to look at or what at one time to in principle say, okay, I think I could solve this? Do you need to do the whole retina? Do you need to do a piece that is mm-hmm. so many millimeters?
Yeah.
What's the gist?
That's a very complicated question and depends on many details. So, I mean, of course, this is a very, very, very simplified scheme of a retina. That was just one ganglion cell and seems to be very homogeneous and translation invariant. So the real retina is much more complicated, and we'll get to that in two or three slides. And then also, things are happening on different levels. So there is a scale that's essentially the receptive field of a ganglion cell that is maybe a few hundred micrometers, with which you can describe a lot about, probably a lot about what the ganglion cell is doing. But then there are additional inputs that come from far away in the retina through processes that span several millimeters across the retina. So if you want to know everything, you probably have to go to a scale that's close to the entire retina. But you know, we don't need to want to know everything in a first step. But that's part of the story, that the retina is much more complicated than one may assume. Okay, so there's some justification in believing that the retina is solved, because if you look, for example, into textbooks, this is sometimes what they try to make you believe, because there's a very simple function that's associated with the retina that comes from looking at the receptive fields of ganglion cells. And it's often thought that the function of the retina in its entirety is captured by these centers round shape of ganglion cells that come in on-center cells, where the receptive field center is activated by increases in light intensity, and activity is suppressed by light in the periphery or in the surrounding area. And then the opposite would be an off-center ganglion cell, where darkening in the center of the receptive field activates the cell. This has been found for many ganglion cells. It can explain a lot of experiments. And the basic idea behind this is that this receptive field acts as something, as we see here by the signs, the idea is that in the center, light intensity is summed up, and then the light intensity in the periphery would be subtracted from this, which would correspond to more or less a simple linear operation. So you can think of this as a linear spatial filter that is applied to a visual image, and thereby determines the activity of a ganglion cell, so that activity represents increases in the preferred contrast pattern. So for an on-center ganglion cells, for example, increases in light intensity in the center and decreases in light intensity in the periphery. And this has also been so successful because it can relate easily to important functions. First of all, it can explain, for example, how ganglion cells respond to spots of light of different sizes very nicely. And a useful function that it appears to perform for visual processing is that it enhances spatial contrast. So if there's an edge or a small spot, then of course this cell will be more strongly excited than by a homogeneous illumination. There has been related to the idea that the natural redundancy in visual images is reduced by the structure, with ideas coming from Horace Barlow and other already in the 1960s, and then later it has been shown that you can formally deduce such centers around receptive fields from an approach that assumes that redundancy should be reduced. And therefore, this has been considered as one of the big, maybe closed, successful stories of neuroscience that explain retinal function in terms of these receptive fields. But there are several aspects that speak for the fact that there's more to the retina than centers around receptive fields, so there are several buts, so to speak. And the first one is that it has been known for quite a while that there's a lot of diversity in the retina. And this by now has become an iconic image here of different shapes of cells in the rabbit retina, here ganglion cells, here inhibitory interneurons, amacrine cells from Dick Masland. So based on morphology, it was already found around 20 years ago that there's a lot of diversity, and more recently, a paper from Thomas Euler's lab in Tübingen has made a big splash in the retina community, showing that functionally, by calcium imaging from ganglion cells in this case, you can distinguish through clustering analysis more than 30, probably around 40 different functional cell types. This has been...
Ganglion cells?
These are all ganglion cells, yes. So 40 different types of ganglion cells, each one of them tile the retina with their receptive fields. This has been found in the mouse. That's currently the idea. This has been confirmed also more recently in anatomical studies from Sebastian Seung's work, that there are these 40 different types and therefore channels that send signal of the entire visual scene to the rest of the brain.
So,
each of the 40 types tiles, or is thought to tile. For many of them, it has been shown, and for the rest, there's no counter evidence, let's say.
There must be 41 in the retina.
Well, the cells are not arranged. They are all sitting in a single lamina next to each other, but they are intermingled in their types. So the receptive fields of these cells are essentially determined by their dendritic processes. And they, if you want, you know, are arranged in different lamina, although some of them also overlap. So if you want, there are 40 different sheets of these dendritic trees, but intermingled, not cleanly separated, although there's a lot of lamination in the retina. Yeah, it's quite amazing that you have this diversity, and presumably this diversity is there for a reason, and this reason is presumably more than just to get centers around receptive fields and contrast enhancement. Okay, the second but is that it has also long been known that spatial signal integration is not always linear. In the 1960s, Enroth, Kugel, and Robson made the seminal discovery that there are linear cells in the cat retina, which they call X cells, and nonlinear cells that they call Y cells, and they are best distinguished, or they distinguish them, by spatial gratings that reverse in polarity. And when the grating is arranged so that it just straddles the receptive field, so that the receptive field sees both brightening and darkening, then for linear X cells, this cancels out, but for linear Y cells, for nonlinear Y cells, they respond to both phases of the reversal of the grating, showing that things don't cancel out, so they must be nonlinear. And if you look, for example, in the mouse, this Y-type cell behavior seems to be the majority of cells that do this. There are linear cells, but the majority seems to be nonlinear in that sense, that they respond to reversing gratings at both phases. So this original finding was in the cat, and therefore the term Y cell, strictly speaking, also refers to these types of cells in the cat. For the mouse, also, they have been found, often they're called Y cells or Y cell-like cells.
One more
thing, Y-like cells? Y-like cells or Y cell-like cells. I mean, this is terminology. I would call them Y cells also in the mouse retina. Okay, so there's nonlinear. In the primate, this can also be found. They also exist. There's much less known about this type of spatial interaction in the primate retina. Although more recently, E.J. Chichinisky and Fredericki have shown that many cells that they recall, in particular parasol cells, can also be strongly nonlinear in that respect. So it exists. So it's best known in the magnocellular stream, and there it seems that off-type magnocellular cells are strongly nonlinear, on-type cells less so, leaning more to the linear side. But then it depends a little bit on stimulation conditions, illumination, and so on. But clearly there is also nonlinear processing in the primary retina. Okay, and these nonlinearities and this diversity presumably is good for something, and in some cases we have an idea of what it is good for, because there are specific functions that seem to be solved by ganglion cells or by certain types of ganglion cells. The best known example may be color opponency. So certain neurons in the primate retina, also in our retina, have color opponency and therefore seem to signal color information. Other well-known examples are direction selectivity. You don't find this only in cortex, you find this also in the retina, cells that respond preferentially to moving objects in one direction, but are inhibited by motion in the opposite direction, a specific cell type. Similarly, orientation selectivity. This has come up in recent years, although there was also information from 20, 30 years ago, that there are certain cell types that respond to bars of a preferred orientation. And then, as David already has mentioned, there may be more specific or complicated functions, such as object motion sensitivity, which has been reported by Marcus Meister's lab. So cells that don't respond well under images that move globally, as would be the case under eye movements, but that are very sensitive to local motion, so of an object that moves in front of a differentially moving background. And then finally, this gives me the opportunity to also show some example from our lab, cells that we call for which we have found that they are sensitive to recurring images. And this is a study that I don't want to talk about here, but mention very briefly, where we looked at how cells respond to simulated saccades. We took a grating and shifted that every second to a different spatial phase, as shown here. And in between these rapid shifts of the grating, there was a fixation at one out of four different spatial phases. And when we looked at the responses in relation to the 16 possible transitions and found one particular cell type, maybe 5% of the cells, we found a lot of diversity in the patterns. But one that I want to highlight here that has a second response peak. So there's a first response peak during the saccade, and then after the saccade, at the new fixation, there's a second peak, if and only if the starting position of the grating and the target position of the grating was the same. So if the same image reappeared. We later found that these are so-called transient off alpha cells. This terminology comes from the morphology. So that seems to be particular cell types that does this. And we think that it may have a function in, for example, correcting eye movements. If the eye position drifts away and then is reset to the original position, they may signal that this was a successful reset. And you can explain this mechanism, and we found also that there are two types of inhibition involved with two types of neurotransmitters. They inhibit each other, and that's one of the examples that where we say we do some inference here about the circuitry by coming from such a function and then finding inhibitory interneurons that are involved to generate it. Okay, and then finally, that's just to show the diagonal. Finally, also, there's a big movement in trying to understand, go away from these artificial stimuli of gratings and spots of light to natural stimuli. And one of the big findings there is that at the moment we don't really have a good model that can explain how ganglion cells respond to natural stimuli. And the model that would be based on a receptor field is the well-known linear, non-linear model. I don't want to go into details, but essentially here, the receptive field in space and time is used as a linear filter for a visual stimulus that comes in. And what comes out of this linear filter is then transformed via some non-linear function into a firing rate. And the responses according to this firing rate can then be compared with measured responses. This is here data from a salamander retina from our lab for such a movie here. With different trials, you see that there are very reliable responses, but such a simple model just based on a linear receptive field cannot explain this. So you see that there's very little match here of the model output to the data. So we need better models.
Wait, Tim, that's one ganglion cell.
That's one ganglion cell, exactly. And these are maybe 30 repetitions of the same movie here stacked on top of each other. Each small dot or line is one spike.
And LN model was formed with a linear filter doing correlation based on the movie itself?
Not the movie itself. Here we obtain the receptive field through an alternative stimulus, a white noise stimulus. But
white noise stimulus gives you a model which is inappropriate for...
Yes. But also if you get the receptive field through such a stimulus, which you can do, it doesn't help much. It helps a little, but doesn't help much. Yeah, so that's in some sense exactly the point. You need to go beyond this LN model. And there are simple fixes that you can do. You can add feedback that helps a little bit, but not much. But I think what we really need here is a model that takes apart this receptive field here. It has multiple components of the receptive field. We'll call the subunit in a second. And we believe that this may be a big step forward. Not only we believe this, but also other labs, like the lab of E.J. Chichuniski or Fred Rieke, have looked at this recently and are also going in a similar direction of wanting to infer the structure inside the receptive field to get better models. Yes, Misha.
I don't understand here. You have a very precise spike.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it says that the rate distribution is negative. So why do you... So this model that predicts the rate should be... To me, it sounds like a wrong approach. It should predict the spike.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes.
So the rates are only involved when there is some kind of jitter and
plasticity. Yeah. There's very little stochasticity, that's true. So, I mean, we can probably go into an hour talk about rate versus temporal coding in the retina, and I'm also much leaning towards the temporal side, though. Although here we believe that much of this strong reliability comes from the fact that these cells are just cells with a high firing threshold, a strong feedback, so that when there's a strong stimulus coming in, they just fire. And then the feedback helps to also regularize the responses, make it very precise. And this is also something that you can get from a firing rate if just the peaks in the firing rate are strong enough. For example, through a strong nonlinear transformation. So this may be not the best type of analysis for such a model to distinguish between rate or temporal codes. They sort of merge there because the rates just fluctuate on a very small time schedule, time scale. But there are other ways of looking into rate and temporal code here. Yes?
I'm wondering if anybody has any idea of where this information is stored, if Sonar storage, Dendrite, or where is it right now? Because when I'm having this repeat response, and I maybe not, or this accumulation response, we need to store it somewhere. And people have had trouble finding plasticity in the record. Mm-hmm. So where, what's the guess?
So do you see storage from these responses here? Sorry?
Previous one.
Oh, here, for example. Yes, absolutely, yeah.
But even if you look at the one where you go to the next slide, I mean, mm-hmm. there's sort of I'm not sure if you show the data effects, there's sort of things that seem to come in upon repetition. So, I mean,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, if you're referring to things like here where the response sort of fades out, we believe this is just fatigue of the retina. So over many trials, you know, responses, that's the hard life of an experimentalist, are not never really stationary. Here we do have a case where there's some sort of memory. And we can measure the time scale of this memory, right? It has to remember the previous image, and that turns out to be around 300 milliseconds. So if you make this transition longer than 300 milliseconds, you lose the specificity for the recurrence. We believe this time scale here is set by a slow inhibitory current that just lingers for 300 milliseconds. Why it does that, we don't know. Presumably the amacrine cell that gives this inhibition is just slow. It's like a low-pass filter in the system. But it's also not a long time scale, right?
Can you specifically block this by getting rid of one amacrine cell?
So we can, this would be a different talk, but I can tell you very briefly. So you can do two types of manipulations that get away with the specificity. You can block glycinergic inhibition, and this causes responses here for all 16 transitions. So presumably, we think that here, in these off-diagonal transitions, responses are suppressed by glycinergic inhibition. And then you can put on a blocker that specifically blocks transmission through GABA-A-mediated inhibition, and that then reduces does away with these second peaks here. So you put in an inhibition blocker, you lose responses, so there must be an indirect effect of GABA-A inhibition. So we think that it's this GABA-A inhibition that acts on the glycinergic inhibition, giving us this additional sign switch. Yeah, you shouldn't tempt me because I'm very fascinated by this. Indeed. Okay, but let me go back to the main story by saying we need additional models, obviously, and we believe that these better models come by breaking up the receptive field into their substructure. Okay, so all of these aspects that I've shown you, nonlinear spatial integration, specific functions, are thought to come primarily from the fact that ganglion cells pool their input over an array of several presynaptic bipolar cells, which are the cells that provide the excitatory input to these cells, and that at the synapse between bipolar cells and ganglion cells, things are nonlinear. As you would expect at many synapses here, it may not be so obvious because these bipolar cells, as I said, they don't produce spikes, or as far as we know. Typically, they don't produce spikes. So things could also be linear here, but it turns out that for many of the connections here, there seems to be a strong sort of rectifying nonlinearity, which is a source of nonlinear signal processing in the retina and the scaffold, as we believe, for many of the computations. So that means that the receptive field, let's say the receptive field center of a ganglion cell, is broken up into these smaller circles, which we call subunits, or functionally, anatomically, they should correspond to the receptive fields or the area of presynaptic bipolar cells.
What did you plot here?
This red line, that would be the synaptic transmission. So if you want, on the x-axis, the activation of the bipolar cell, and on the y-axis, the signal that is received by the ganglion cell. So if there's a positive activation of the bipolar cell, this is transmitted to the ganglion cell, let's say through a depolarization. If there's a negative signal in the bipolar cells, and they are thought to be more or less linear, indeed, so they can depolarize, hyperpolarize, then there would be no signal received by the ganglion cell because it's thresholded. Okay, so there is, we believe there's the substructure.
And then you have different polarities or on
off? Yes, so I mean, both, if you want both these circuits come as on types and off type cells. The general idea is that if you have an off type ganglion cell, it receives input from off type bipolar cells. And if you have an on type ganglion cell, it receives input from on type bipolar cells. So this is where the big unknowns in the retina start, right? I mean, one thing is known that there are also on-off type ganglion cells that mix inputs from on-type bipolar cells and off-type bipolar cells. But let's say with a simple case where we have, for example, have an on-type bipolar cell, the idea is that it primarily receives input from one type of bipolar cell, but new anatomical studies tell us that there may also be multiple types. If all of these are functional relevant, we don't know yet. I'll give you a little bit of information about this later. Okay, so there are these subunits inside the receptor field of a ganglion cell. Why are they important? They're important because if there are small stimuli or structured stimuli, they influence how the ganglion cell reacts. Let's assume we have a bright spot of light and a dark spot of light, maybe on a gray background. Then if they fall into the same subunit, things should cancel because these bipolar cells are linear. But if they fall into different subunits, then they do not cancel because of this rectification here, and the ganglion cell will be activated by such a stimulus as compared to such a stimulus. That means that in principle, from the responses to structured stimuli, we should be able to read out where these subunits are, for what patterns things are canceled out and for what they are not canceled out. And that is the challenge that we've posed to ourselves and that I want to pose to you, and to the computational and theoretical wizards here that maybe can help me and the field with that.
Why don't you just take this and move it on?
Exactly, so that would be one approach. Just take two small spots, move them around, and present them at 10,000 different locations and hope for an experiment that for which you have 48 hours of recording time. We may actually try something like this with a little bit of more sophistication where you know, through monitoring the responses in a closed loop fashion, then you select new good locations. But a priori, we don't even know where the receptive field of a ganglion cell is, right? So it's not that easy to do this.
But so we'll.
Yeah, exactly. So this is what we would want to see, yes. And then also, you know, coming from a computational background, it's of course fun to do something more sophisticated than just to present two spots, right? You could present many spots at the same time and intermingle all these analyses and then, you know, extract through computational analyses these subunits, and this is actually what we want to do.
But can I understand? I don't understand your question. Is your question, I want to read off specific nonlinear subunits that I'm mentally associating with bipolar cells? Or is it, I want to be able to predict the response to interesting stimuli? These are very different questions. So which is your question?
Yeah, so we leave where they are strongly related, and therefore we try to tackle them both in the same approach. So we want these subunits for any ganglion cell that we record, and then we want to use them both for understanding the circuitry, so understanding how many bipolar cells are connected to a ganglion cell. Do these bipolar cells overlap between different ganglion cells? How big are they? But then also, once we have them, we also want to use them to build better models that allow us also then to go into other functions, like adaptation.
But I think that without exception, all the phenomena you mentioned relied on the non-trivial part was in the inhibition.
Mm-hmm. Let me come to this in a second. Yes, hold on to your question. Absolutely, yes, inhibition is centrally important. I'll have a slide to answer this, so hold on for a second. For color-sensitive stimuli, you mean? It's something that we could do, which we don't do at the moment for simplicity, and because in the mouse retina that we primarily work on, and in the salamander retina, there's color processing is difficult. There's not that much known. There's not much of color processing, as far as we know, so we don't do this. But more recently, we've also restarted recording from primate retina. I'm jumping ahead again. And there we will try this also with color stimuli, yes. Okay, so the challenge here for us, for me, for everyone, is to find a combination of visual stimuli that are suited in analysis to infer this layout of subunits from recorded activity, let's say from recorded spikes.
What's the evidence for subunits? Just because you couldn't treat
There's lots of evidence. Huge amount of evidence.
Yeah, I mean, the primary evidence, or originally the sapiens were suggested based on these reversing gratings, because they are a simple way of explaining these gratings. Then the evidence that bipolar cells are important came from recordings, intracellular recordings in individual ganglion cells, where you could see the same pattern also in the excitatory input current. So it comes from Jonathan Demp and Peter Sterling about 15, 20 years ago. So that sort of convinced everyone in the field that is the bipolar cells. Although it may not be completely settled, but maybe we'll get some more information through this from here. So it's a working hypothesis with a lot of evidence, as Ava said. Okay, so just to drive this home more concretely, here again we have our simplified schematic view. And what we want to focus on is this layer of ganglion cells and bipolar cells. And one of the things that we will be interested in is that finding the connections, given that it's not a homogeneous setting, but that both the ganglion cells and the bipolar cells come in many different types. About 40 types of ganglion cells. For bipolar cells, we know it's about 14 types, in the mouse retina at least. And they can be connected very diversely from different types to different ganglion cells. And maybe coming back to this original question, why don't we wait 1 or 2 years to settle this through other methods? There have been attempts to start this, for example, through electron microscopy. Reconstructing bipolar cells and ganglion cells and looking at their connectivity, and this just shows you that this is really not a simple type of analysis that you have to do here. So this is the layer of ganglion cells that you see here. This is the layer of interneurons, bipolar cells, and amacrine cells. The bipolar cells are primarily here in this upper region. Amacrine cells would be down here. And you see that it's really a packed pile of cell bodies that then connect to these ganglion cells. So people are working on this, and they will provide a lot of complementary information. But seeing the functional connections here between these chunk of bipolar cells and this layer of ganglion cells is not experimentally also not straightforward. Yes.
So I understand in rainbow,
So I mean, here you don't see it because the red cells that are shown here. Primarily it's only cell bodies that are shown here, and the neurons are shown only from one type of a bipolar cell, which stratify in this region. And here you see that for this particular bipolar cell, it's not a very finely defined layer. It's a bit more diffuse. For other, this is the red ones are single cell type. Yes, a single type of bipolar cell. And you find others that are then stratifying different regions. And from this, you get a lot of information about the overlap in which layers bipolar cells as well as ganglion cells stratify. But it's not always a one-to-one match that you can tell from the fact that they stratify in the same layer that they should or should not be connected.
But eventually EM should...
Eventually EM should be able to give us a lot of information about which cell types can have connections, whether these are functionally relevant connections. It may be helpful to have additional approaches like this one here. If you want, sure.
There's still a question of whether one can really see
Yeah.
Because I'm obviously have a certain bias.
Yeah, so do I, which I don't want to have me be influenced too much by. So in my view, these are, in a way, complementary approaches. We would be very interested in having better ideas from anatomy about connectivity, but even if we do have that, we also would want that for that particular cell that we are recording from, so that at the same time we can use this information, for example, for placing stimuli onto the receptor field, or for relating this to other stimuli that we've recorded for this particular ganglion cell, for example, with a natural movie. And to make this connection to this functional investigation of what cells do for natural stimuli, what they do under inhibition blockers, I think for years to come we will still need other ways of looking at the identifying supplements. So at the moment, there's no particular aspect of this work that targets gap junctions. Although we do believe, depending on what we see, we can find traces of ganglions of gap junctions. For example, and again, I'm jumping ahead, for some cells, we see that subunits are surprisingly big, and there the hypothesis is that these are combinations of bipolar cells that are coupled by gap junctions, which is now subject to being tested. Okay, so let me continue a little bit. That was the question, what about inhibitory interneurons? Most of the functions that we've seen are strongly determined by inhibitory circuitry, and we believe that's true. So our belief here is, so there are two types of inhibitory neurons here. At the connections between photoreceptors and bipolar cells, there are so-called horizontal cells, and one layer further between bipolar cells and ganglion cells, there are amacrine cells that modify the signal transmission and influence the selectivity of the cells. So our view here at the moment is that these inhibitory neurons are thought to strongly shape how ganglion cells integrate information, both over space and time. But they don't influence the layout of the subunits which come from the bipolar cells. So in some sense, the bipolar cells provide the scaffold. This is where the information comes from. And the inhibitory interneurons then gate these signals or modify the signal transmission and thereby influence what the ganglion cell does with these subunit inputs. So they determine the function, but the layout is determined by the bipolar cells. That's our working hypothesis.
What's layout? What's the definition of layout?
So layout, with layout, what I mean here with layout is essentially this pattern here, where the subunits are, where signals come in that are being put linear or nonlinear.
So inside receptor field.
I mean, both functional and anatomical. So the idea is that the subunits here are determined functionally by which signals are being integrated linear and across boundaries of subunits nonlinear. That would be functional layout.
So that includes the inhibition.
So that can include the inhibition. For example, part of the shape of these subunits may be determined by inhibition, but more so, for example, the temporal structure, how fast these subunits signal their signals to one type of ganglion cell or another. Yes. The inhibition provides additional nonlinearity. Yes. I sometimes like to think of these subunits as a combination of a bipolar cell that provides input plus the local amacrine cells that influence this. As far as we know, most of this is determined by the bipolar cell, also because of the stimuli that we use to identify these subunits. They probably don't trigger inhibition very strongly. But as I said, this is the working hypothesis. We're not sure in the end. I'll show you some way of how we study this. But let's say for the general approach, we turn to ignore them just to get started somewhere. Probably many, and most of them we don't know, but one idea is that they provide additional selectivity, so they may just be turned on by a specific stimulus, let's say a stimulus in the periphery somewhere, that then shuts down signaling in the way that's nonlinear, because these amacrine cells are nonlinear. But for other stimuli, they're not being excited. I don't think we can put a general functional general form of nonlinear processing.
But general nonlinearity is also threshold nonlinearity. Threshold
like nonlinearity. For horizontal cells, probably not. For amacrine cells, that will likely depend on cell type. So there are also 40 to 50 different types of amacrine cells. You can't throw them in the same bag. Some of these will be strongly nonlinear, others likely more linear.
There
They are most likely, there will be that as well as subtractive inhibition. In some sense, the inhibitory network is the big unknown, right? I'm also, you know, waving my hands here a little bit because we just don't know much about these cells. We have some specific examples. Some are involved in determining direction selectivity in the retina. Some are involved in shaping the surround of the center surround receptor field. But probably for 80-90% of the amacrine cells, we don't know much. Okay, so our approach and my suggestion would be to see how far we can get by ignoring them for now, and then maybe seeing later if there are specific effects. Yes, please.
So the bipolar, so what gives you the on and off shape of the receptive field if there is no inhibition? And you have this sound only from the on bipolar.
So the surround will come from inhibition from horizontal cells and amacrine cells. Yes, that comes from inhibition. So let's say at the moment we focus for the subunits, we focus on the center, yes. So we ignore the fact that there's a surround. Surprisingly, also for many cells, depending on recording conditions, we don't see a strong surround. So it's not the case that every cell really has a strong center surround inhibition. That seems to also be strongly.
But that depends completely on the stimulus.
That depends on the stimulus and it depends strongly on the cell type. Okay, let's see how far we can go with this. So we record from the retina. So what do we do, finally? We record from the retina in a dish. So we isolate retinas primarily either from mouse or from axolotl. I show you both data from both. So I always try to mark this with a little icon here where the data comes from. And it can stay alive in the dish for many hours, up to a day. Most recently, we've also started by recording from not human primate retina, but I don't have data to show you with this at the moment. And then we stimulate the retina by projecting a computer monitor onto the photoreceptor layer. And the whole thing happens while the retina is sitting on a multi-electrode array. For example, just a glass dish with small wires on it that can record from individual ganglion cells. And more recently also with CMOS-based arrays that have something like 4,000 electrodes, where we aim getting closer to recording from at least entire parts of the retina, so entire sets of ganglion cells. All right, a typical stimulus that we use and that I want to focus here is spatiotemporal white noise, so just individual pixels on the screen or small rectangles that are drawn from random distributions. And that's useful for a lot of approaches, and primarily we use it also to get receptive fields by recording then spikes, let's say from a single neuron here, and then looking at the stimulus that precedes a cell. That's a well-known spike-triggered average. So if we average all these short segments that precede the spike, we get a short movie, as shown here for a cell from the salamander retina. This is periodic because it's the same movie is looping again and again, but what's happening in one of the, on average for one spike is that in this region here, there's a brief darkening of the stimulus, so that tells us this is where the receptive field is, so we can get the spatial arrangement of the receptive field as well as the time course of the illumination in this field. Okay, just to give you an example of how we use this for large populations, this is a large set of ganglion cells that we recorded in a mouse retina, and then we can look at the properties of the cells that we recorded here, like the receptive field sizes, how fast the temporal filters are, and other properties, and use clustering approaches to separate these into different channels. And for some cell types, that works well. And if it works well, you can see this typically by this fact that the receptive fields of that cell type then tend to tile the retina with some but little overlap between themselves. Yes, please.
You know why there's that kind of notch in the set of receptive fields you've recorded?
Yeah, I mean, this always depends on the experimental condition where we have a good contact between the array and the retina. But in this case, it turns out that this is where the optic nerve was. So this big hole here comes from the optic disc, so there are no ganglion cells.
If this move in our play, the cell will respond to this?
Actually, we have never done this, but the assumption would be yes. And for a cell like this one here that has this movie here, if you play a dark spot that appears, it will just, at the right location, it will just respond very strongly. Whether we can increase this by this particular time course, we've never tested, because we always determine this receptive fields post hoc at the moment.
I'm a bit surprised you get so many clusters for white noise, and so I'm wondering what's your criterion for the clusters. Also, I'm wondering, did you try clustering also with other data, other stimuli?
Yeah, so we, I mean, this is still under development, so to speak, and this would be an entire different talk, how to do this cell type classification based on clustering. And we try different approaches, including this the stimulus that has been developed in Thomas Euler's lab with this chirp-like structure, so different spatial, different temporal frequencies. And we get, you know, difference in the details that will have to be resolved, but overall similar structure.
We did it with something we call the barcode.
Yeah, okay, let's talk about this later. That would be interesting. Okay, good. Just some details, because so you know where the data, the analysis that I show you come from, and maybe also to judge what the potential is for doing data analysis here. So the stimulus that we have, that we typically use, is a spatial temporal white noise with small pixels, many pixels that are small, for example, 30 micrometers in size or 15 micrometers, compared to a typical receptive field that's several hundred micrometers, so it's a much smaller spatial scale, also much smaller than is commonly used, updated at a high rate, and then we record with the same boring stimulus for up to several hours, maybe 4 hours, to get a lot of spikes, like 10,000 or several hundred thousand of spikes from individual cells, so that we can then use this data for statistical inference. And often we insert what we call frozen noise, so some of these noise sections that are repeated, for which then we can compute firing rates as a test set for models that we build. Okay, so the challenge, as I said, is now to find these subunits, and our approach here starts by throwing out time, by integrating out time, because we're interested in spatial structure, and we do this in a very simple manner by taking the temporal filter that we obtained from the spike target average and using that as weights to weight the frames that preceded a spike, right, with a temporal filter that is given by the cell itself, to get what we call an effective spatial stimulus, or weighted average stimulus. So this is one pattern that, integrated over time, we believe is, a, in a sense, a good stimulus for that cell because that triggered a spike. Yes, please.
Do you think that every subunit has the same temporal filter?
We believe they're probably close because they probably come from different types of bipolar cells. We can test this a posteriori, and what we've seen is that they come out to be very similar, yes. Yeah, but it's an assumption that we put in here, and we test its robustness.
And if you're looking at the surround, we know the surround is slow, so you're going to use a different type of temporal filter for the surround.
Yes, but we ignore the surround here. Yeah. Which, by the way, was also a little bit, you know, this cell that I've shown you, as you see often for these stimuli, we don't see much of a surround, right? It's strongly determined here by, at least for this kind of stimulus here, there's not much activation of the surround. There's not much of a surround popping out here, which is something that we often find. So we don't feel so bad about ignoring the surround. Okay, so now we have these effective spatial patterns that trigger a spike, and for every spike we get such a pattern, so these turn out then to be several 10,000s of patterns. And we believe that the structure that generated the spike, the substructure of the receptive field, is now buried in these patterns. And this is what we want to extract now from these patterns. And the technique that we use this, okay, we call this the effective spike-triggered stimulus ensemble. Stimuli that are triggered on spikes and effective because their time is averaged out. Okay, so and the approach that we use was inspired by a paper from Daniel Lee and Sebastian Tsiong from last millennium.
that have used a technique that's called non-negative matrix factorization for analyzing images. So what they did is they tried to find basis functions that can describe images, in this case, images of faces. And they do this by trying to describe every image as a weighted superposition of modules. You can think of these as basis functions, so that you can reconstruct this image. By using a large database and learning these modules under the constraint that both the modules and the weights should not contain negative values, so non-negative, they find that the modules correspond to what they call a parts-based representation. So individual modules, basis functions contain parts like, what is this here, the mouth maybe, the eyes, so different parts of faces. And that's in some sense also what we want. We want to find the parts of receptive fields, the subunits, and therefore we thought this could be a good starting point to analyze our data with non-negative matrix factorization. So we do essentially the same thing. Instead of faces, we take these spike-triggered stimulus patterns and we try to decompose them in a set of modules, and these are then should correspond to the subunits if things work well, times a set of weights, so that every one of these successful stimulus patterns can be approximated by a linear superposition of these weights.
Do you use the same subunits for just one cell, or do you share them across cells?
At the moment, we do this for every cell individually, and then we compare afterwards.
The weights would be
non-negative. Exactly. So sharp I, so here we have negative weights. The modules are always positive. So what we here do is actually a variant of non-negative matrix factorization, which is called semi-non-negative matrix factorization. The primary reason being that our stimulus patterns are primarily, they are based on a stimulus that's on average gray, and then we have positive and negative deviations, brightening and darkening, so they are, so therefore we have there have positive and negative values. In order to capture this, we also need to have the weights potentially be negative.
So the non-negativity is only the
module. So only the modules here are have a non-negativity constraint. So it's a variant of this. For each spike, we get one of these patterns. So one of these patterns here corresponds to one spike that was elicited by this weightening over time. This is a single spike. So you can think of this also, disregarding time, that as if we had presented several patterns individually of the structure, and then these are the ones that triggered the spikes, and many others did not trigger a spike.
The weightening you took from the average of all spikes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. So the assumption here is that over the entire receptive field, for every subunit, for every spike, we have approximately the same temporal filter. So the assumption turns out to be not a bad assumption.
Yeah.
Exactly. We can check this posteriori. Okay, good. So this semi-non-negative matrix factorization, together with spike triggering, we then call spike triggered non-negative matrix factorization, or STNMF to make it simpler. Okay, I think I'm...
We're timeless.
Okay, we're timeless. Oh, that's risky for you. But it's your own fault. You ask all these nice questions. Okay, I want to very briefly, something that I never do, and also I guess I was discouraged by the email that says no details, but nonetheless I want to show you a little bit of details about the method, also, you know, just to trigger potential thoughts and ideas that you may have for me for improving this. Okay, so the math behind this is that we have an objective function here, and that is we want to minimize this structure here, that would be the set of stimuli, and this W times M would be the decomposition here of the weights times the modules. This is shown here again. So this S here is a big matrix that has all the spikes, for each spike has all the pixels of the stimulus structure as a row here. So this is a really huge spike. As I said, we have maybe 10,000 or 100,000 spikes. So this would be 100,000 rows here, and the pixels are all the pixels in this maybe 20 by 20 stimulus pattern that we had, so maybe 400 columns here. So we decompose this then in a set of weights, and a set of modules, and the modules then in the end in each row, which is also composed of the number of pixels, will be the spatial patterns that correspond to subunits. And then the dimension reduction, if you want, comes from the fact that we assume that there's a small number of modules here in this decomposition. So this is the objective function that we try to minimize. It's the Frobenius norm of the matrix here. So it's essentially taking all the elements in this difference matrix here and the square of that and then minimizing that. Yes. Yes.
Then you get
this, then
you get what, spike or no spike?
Then I get, so if so, for one spike, so to speak, we take all the modules and we multiply them with the weights for those modules, and then this gives us, so to speak, the approximated pattern that generated this spike. And from the next spike, we're going to have different weights for the same modules and try to approximate the pattern that generated that spike.
The weights change from spike to
spike, yes. So the interpretation is that for each spike, a different combination of modules created that spike. Maybe it was one module that was activated strongly, one subunit, and the others didn't contribute. So that one module for that spike should have a strong weight and the others a small weight. And for a second module, for a second spike, maybe a different module or two different modules that created that spike. Yeah, I see your point, yes. So actually, what we can do afterwards, we can average these weights, and these weights are then, these average weights are weights then in the classical sense. So how on average this module contributed to generating spikes, so what the weight of that module is for the, so weights is not in the network, neural network sense of weights, but in the, you know, pattern decomposition sense of weights, how much the modules contribute.
So there's no penalty in this objective function for generating a spike when, in fact, your neuron did not generate a spike, right? So the only thing that we're matching is those patterns that generated a spike. But there are patterns that did not, okay, and this mode might generate spikes on.
Yeah, so no, we don't use the stimuli that did not generate a spike, with the idea being that this comes from a very simple stimulus distribution, white noise, Gaussian distributed. I mean, implicitly it's there that, you know, out of this simple distribution, these are the special ones that generated spikes. Yeah, but We don't consider which patterns were then given that did not generate spikes, which are many more, of course, than one that generated spikes.
So, a question related to the question of Chaim and Misha. So if you did this with first average over all spikes, mm-hmm. then did this, you would get the same module, presumably. You hope that you would get the same modules.
So if we average over all spikes, we throw away the information about the modules, right? We just get the average distribution, we get the receptive field. Yeah. So we need to know the fact which pixels contributed to individual spikes. How did they, you know, combine joint forces, right? Which, instead of averaging out in order to generate a spike. And for the next spike, this may have been a different set of stimulus pixels because it was a different module. So we need this resolution on the single spike.
More local. You have a certain image at a certain size.
Yes.
And you want to break it.
Absolutely, yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because the idea is that in the subunit picture, you know, pixels that fall into the same subunit, they can cooperate, so to speak, in order to generate a spike. And therefore they will be more strongly, you know, activated together when there's a spike elicited.
And so your argument is that by taking this white noise stimulus, it's fine enough, the resolution is fine enough that you will not lump two modules together. Even if you look.
Exactly, yes. So what we have to do is we have to make these pixels small enough so that several pixels can fall into a subunit, right? Otherwise we don't have the resolution. Okay, so I want to bring this up also because we don't use this straightforward objective function as is, but then we add a penalty term which helps us make these modules sparser. And it's an ad hoc penalty. I don't want to get into details. The MI are the columns of this matrix here. It's
what's MI?
So it's an L, exactly, it's an L1.
So you're double spacing the non-negativity.
Yes, in a way, yes. So we have two ways of trying to enforce sparsity. We do this for practical reasons, but this is exactly, you know, I would be very happy if someone with experience comes to me and talks to me about regularization of these things. So this is an L1 norm, but we then take the square of the L1 norm for practical reasons, because then we can insert this into the minimization here by just extending the matrices by one row and one column. So that's not so important that it's squared. That's a technical thing. It's an L1 norm for sparsity. So MI is the ith column of this matrix M, and then we take the. Yeah, I'm not sure about the terminology. I would consider this as an L1 norm that, in some sense, artificially gets squared afterwards. Okay, I'm happy to hear that. Okay, so we add this, and this is a thing that we're still working on, optimizing this. I just want to let you know this is part of the method. Okay, so how do we solve this? Fortunately, there are a lot of techniques out there that tell us how to approach this optimization. Essentially, we do a way where we iterate between optimizing W and M. So W, optimizing W given M, that's a simple least squares operation because there's no constraint. And then there's optimizing M given W with a constraint that it's non-negative. This is computationally non-trivial, but there are methods there. We use something that's called the active set method. I don't want to go into details, but some iterations you can. The important thing is that you can find the optimal solution here. But then by iterating these two, you approach a stationary solution, but because it's an iteration of two optimization processes, it's not guaranteed to find a global optimum. So we have to deal with potentially local optima or local minima in this case. And the way we do this is that we just do it with a lot of different initial conditions and then take the best solution. And then in addition, we insert manual perturbations of the solution. For example, we do a lot, some of these, you know, going back and forth between optimizing M and W, let's say 100 iterations of that, and then we perturb the current solution and check whether this helps us in finding a better solution. And these perturbations are then guided by what we expect in the subunits to find. For example, we delete a subunit and ask, does that help our optimization? We split a subunit into two halves and see whether that helps. So these are the tricks that we try to play to optimize, to escape local minima. And again, I would be very happy to discuss this with someone if someone has some additional ideas.
How important have those perturbations been? I guess pretty important since you included them and they're complicated.
Yeah, exactly. So they have been pretty important in having this run more or less efficiently. So often you see that a solution looks reasonable, but really there are two subunits that are sort of intermingled and they should look like they should belong together. So there's one row missing in one subunit and that row appears in a different subunit. And by including these perturbations, it just happens that one perturbation, you know, deletes one of the subunits, the two subunits are then combined into a single subunit and you see the residual just drop sharply, which you would have never, you know, or may have taken thousands of iterations to get without these perturbations. So from a practical point of view, this has been very important.
Why global minimum? Maybe one of the local minimums is what
actually. Yeah, I mean, in a sense, that's also what we take. So what we do in the end, we take these 100 different initializations and use that to check, you know, maybe the 20 or 30 best of them, do they approximately match? They never match on the single pixel level. So we don't ever claim to get on the single pixel level the optimum, right? But we find that in some sense, they are like identical twins with small variations between themselves. And that's for us then sufficient to believe that we have a good solution. Maybe not the global optimum, but something that is robust over initial conditions.
There's a lot of symmetry in the program.
Yeah, indeed. So we I mean, we do that. We shuffle the responses, the modules, and we get rid of this degeneracy in the problem by some other tricks that I don't want to, or measures that I don't want to talk about. Okay, so it's computationally quite heavy from the operation that you do, but also from the computation time. So these are huge matrices. And currently at the moment, if we analyze one cell with maybe 20,000 spikes, it takes us a day to analyze this thoroughly. And that's using parallel processing on a 40 processor computer, though in MATLAB. Sorry, why so many spikes? Why we have used so many spikes?
Why do you have to use all
those? I mean, it turns out that the more spikes we have, the better. I mean, it also works with 10,000 spikes. But if we have the data, we may as well use it because it just gets us more accuracy. But even then, we don't get too much less than a day. So yes, so lambda is arbitrary. So we do this ad hoc. We don't do any systematic cross validation here. And essentially, that's because it's so heavy, right? So what we do is we try a couple of values for a couple of cells, and we find that there's a certain range of values that just works well, in the sense that it gives us stable results for many different iterations. But again, I mean, this is in a way a weak spot here that we don't have a good way of doing systematic metaparameter checking here. From what I read, it's not so uncommon in the field, but of course, it would be nicer to have a different strategy for finding the right lambda here. Okay. Sorry? Yeah, no, so at the moment, no, we're not validating it in a quantitative fashion. Our only validation is that if we vary it, make it much bigger or much smaller than the way that we use it, the subunit sets that we find, I haven't shown you anything, depend much more on initial conditions. So there's a parameter range that works just nicely for giving us robust responses, and therefore that's the regime we take. Admitting that this is a little bit hand-waving, yeah, but I don't have a better solution at the moment.
Do you take the best out of all this
manipulation? For a given lambda in the end, then we take the best, yes. But with checking that, the second best is not very different, and the 20th best also not very different. Okay, let's look with such a measure at a simulation where we have a receptive field here that's composed of 5 subunits. Subunits in receptive field are square shape. That's maybe appropriate for considering neurons in the setting of theoretical physics. And each subunit here is followed by a half-wave rectifying nonlinearity, and then things are summed up. There's another nonlinearity, and then some process to give us spikes. And here we have 5 subunits, so one may think, okay, now we should run this algorithm by using 5 modules and see whether these 5 modules match our subunits. For a real cell, however, we would not know how many subunits there are. Yes?
So, in this picture, okay, so the subunit nonlinearity, I think it represents bipolar cells.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
So can you just remind us on the, since bipolar cells are not spiking, what's the input-output relationship like?
Mm-hmm.
What's the observed nonlinearity between inputs to a bipolar cell and transmitter output?
So the input here in the bipolar cell is more or less linearly related to the light intensity over the receptive field in some time window. And you can think of this as a membrane potential, and the output here would be something like the transmitter released by that cell. And that seems to be nonlinear related because the calcium dynamics that go from membrane potential to transmitter release in the terminal of the bipolar cell is nonlinear.
Okay, and then just to get back to what you said at the beginning, I mean, the calcium concentration then in the presynaptic terminal just doesn't get high enough for you to actually image and use that as a measure of bipolar cell output. you said that you were actually looking at the transmitter release directly, not looking at the calcium signals.
Yeah, so I should say, not we do this, other labs in the field do this, we don't do imaging, so I'm also not the expert to answer this. But what people have told me there is that the simple approach that you would like to do by recording from somata and looking at calcium signals there doesn't work because there are very little calcium signals in the soma because the cells don't spike. And then the calcium signals from the terminal don't travel back enough and aren't strong enough in the soma. So you might be able to do calcium imaging in the soma, in the terminals. But of course, you have so many terminals sitting there in a row that this technically also has been difficult. And glutamate release has been the simpler.
Way back at the beginning of your model, you took the measured spike triggered average, and then you basically approximated by a space function and a time function.
Mm-hmm.
So it's separable. And is that true? Are they really separable?
Not for all cells. Yeah. I skipped over this. Yeah, I mean, it turns out that for practical purposes, for just getting the receptive field shape and size and the temporal filter, it's separable enough that this works quite well, right? Details may be lost. For example, in direction selective cells, the receptive fields turn out to not be separable. Still, we can separate them at least to get a rough shape of the filter and the temporal course. So it depends on what you want to know about this. But for many cells, it seems to be, somewhat separable, enough separable. Mm-hmm.
Okay, how all of your dynamics is contained in the time history of those subunits?
In a way, yes. So this will be this temporal filter that we assume is attached also to the subunits and then inherited by the ganglion cell. And this will be maybe something like 300 milliseconds. So it's like the stimulus in the last 300 milliseconds that determines whether there's a spike now or not. And therefore also the stimuli averaged over the last 300 milliseconds give us the spatial pattern that was successful in generating a spike. But now we only focus on the spatial pattern. And here in this model here, I left out time entirely. I just take, if you want, just spatial patterns that are then filtered by the subunits and then combined in order to give us spikes by a Poisson process. Actually, it should be a Bernoulli process here.
Is the first nominary just a relic and then the second is not?
Say it again? The first one is just half-wave rectification. So negative signals are cut off, positive signals are going through. The second one is the same thing, except that the threshold is shifted a little bit further to the right, just to make the responses a bit sparser. Okay? So anyway, so it's not a terrible model, but it's a very simple model. The interesting aspect is it has subunits, and there's an additional challenge. It has subunits that overlap. So there's one subunit in the center that overlaps with the other four subunits, because that's considered to be a difficult problem for finding subunits. This would be the spike triggered average. It's the average of all the subunits, as you would expect. And then, the point that I wanted to make is that we don't just take five modules here. We don't allow for just five modules, because for a real ganglion cell, we would also not know this. So we take a number of modules that is larger than this and see what happens. So in this case, we analyze this, for example, with 20 potential modules. And this is then what we find. So this is the modules that we extracted from this method here. And you see that five of these 20 subunits have a nice structure. They actually match the subunits that we put in quite nicely. And then the other 15 modules, they look like noise. And this is what they do. They capture noise in these spike-triggered stimuli, and therefore are not then considered to be subunits. Mm-hmm.
And now you will have two sets of five subunits.
Yeah, so in principle.
Why doesn't the algorithm do it?
Mm-hmm. So it could do that, but it would, of course, not help the prediction, and then the sparsity prior takes care of the fact that that is penalized. Okay, so what about a real? So these are the fives that then count in the end. What about a real ganglion cell here taken from the salamander? Essentially, we do the same experiment that we just did in the simulation. Also analyzing this with 20 subunits. In this case, we found that there are, again, a number of nicely localized patches that we find and others that look more like noise. We can confirm that the ones that look like noise are actually noise-like patterns. Because if we take each of these subunits as a spatial filter and analyze how the activation of the stimulus of this spatial filter is then related to the firing rate of the cell, so taking this as a filter and then comparing the filter activation on average over our four-hour-long recording with the spikes that were then elicited, we see that here for these ones that are colored in red, these nine ones, we have a nice monotonic relationship, strong relationship. The stronger the filter activation, the higher the firing rate, whereas for these noise patterns, that they are almost, this relationship is almost flat, so they are not related much to actually generating spikes. And this is what we can analyze, this relationship between, you know, how strongly these filters are activated and the spike rate in an automated fashion to then automatically detect which of these 20 modules are really good subunits that are related to spiking activity. If, say it again.
If you run it a second time, do you get the same set of subunits?
In a way, yes. So I mean, what we do anyway, I explained this a few minutes ago, is that we run this 100 times with 100 different initial conditions. And then this is our sanity check that at least the best 20 of those are near identical matches. So they will differ in where these pixels exactly are in the noise-like subunits. There may be some small differences here, but then we find that the overall layout here of the subunits is similar, and this we can then also check, for example, by fitting each of these localized subunits with a small Gaussian, and then relating this, you know, these would be then the subunits to the receptive field layout. And then we find, for example, for many of these 100 iterations, we essentially get the same layout here with its more like wiggle in between different individual solutions.
It's possible that the constraint is basically to tile it, right? And receptive field. So you can tile with any subset of pixels, which is not bad.
Could be. I'll give you a counter example later, but also then it could mean that if I run it with a different instantiation or a different initialization, then again I get a tiling but at different positions, right? This is not what we find. The subunits then match to very small, up to very small jitter between them. Same number, same location, identical twins that look identical at first sight but then have small, very small differences. But I have another argument in a second. Okay. All right. So this is for a salamander cell. We find also, we've done this also now in the mouse. Mouse data is a bit more noisy typically, but we find similar layouts here. So in principle, the analysis works as well. So in this case, this would be five subunits.
When people are doing these kind of optimizations, finding the support of which modules are used, they often then, after they fix the support, they go back and refit all the weightings and such. And I'm just wondering if you try that, because it might clean this up even more once you think you have the best basic support for the model. Support, I mean zero, non-zero. In the graphical lasso or lasso, you find the non-zeros with the penalty term. And then you take away the L1 penalty and you assume that the
non-zeros. Yeah.
And then you refit.
Yeah, okay, that's an interesting idea. No, we haven't tried this. But maybe I'll ask you later about this again. Okay.
So how does this depend on the pixel size?
We haven't tested this all that much because typically for each, you know, as I said, we try to go for one long recording with stationary conditions. Yeah, I don't have a good answer for this. So it probably... there are some sensitivity to pixel size because obviously if we make the pixels too large, we don't have the spatial resolution to find the subunits. If we make the pixels too small, then the smaller the pixels, the weaker the stimulus becomes for the cell. The fewer spikes we get. So things will become more problematic. That's the only answer I can give you at the moment.
How will it predict spikes in the
test? Could you say that again? Okay, we'll come to this in a second. Maybe I'll speed up a little bit. Okay, so one important question is now, are these subunits really bipolar cells, right? So that has been the assumption that somehow what we get in the end correspond to bipolar cells. And the way we try to test this is going in the salamander retina, where we can do this, to record simultaneously from ganglion cells, and then with a sharp microelectrode from the other side, try to record individual bipolar cells, and then hope that in individual recordings we have a match where we record from ganglion cells, where the recorded bipolar cells is inside the receptor field, for example. And this turns out to work sometimes. So here is an example of a recorded bipolar cell, receptor field, temporal filter in the salamander retina. And here are ganglion receptor fields of ganglion cells that overlap with the bipolar cell receptor field. So the question is now, how do the subunits look with respect to the bipolar cell receptor field? And it's the same bipolar cell here with two ganglion cells that overlap. So this would be the bipolar cell receptor field here in red. This is the layout of extracted subunits that we found here for these two cells. And here in the background, you see the bipolar cell receptor field in a pixel-by-pixel fashion. It maybe becomes a bit clearer if we show this with the outline, the Gaussian that is fitted to the receptor field. And we see that in these two cases, and then statistically often in our analysis, that it's highly significant, we see a good match between individual bipolar cells and individual reconstructed subunits.
Since you have an electrode in the cell, can't you sit there and put in a particular temporal pattern, and then now you're contributing to that subunit in the retinal ganglion cell? And then you should be able to back that out of the analysis. Would that be another cross-check?
That would be a cross-check, and we are working on this, although at the moment I don't have data where this worked. One reason being, if you inject current into a bipolar cell, it's sort of difficult to titrate the right amount. If you stimulate it strongly so that it does have a good, strong effect on the ganglion cell, then it starts adapting a lot after this. And then this becomes a difficult experiment. But one of the things that we are trying at the moment is, for example, silencing this bipolar cell by hyperpolarizing and then seeing how that affects, you know, our analysis, essentially.
Can you go from the other side, for example, measure from febrile bipolar cell, have some approximation about the connectivity between bipolar cells and ganglion cells, try to guess or compute the response of the
Yeah, that would be nice. The problem there is that it's very difficult to record from bipolar cells. It's very difficult to record from an individual one because they are small. You have to poke an electrode blindly into the retina and find one, right? And for many bipolar cells, at least with these techniques, that's, I would say, impossible. Imaging experiments may be able to do what you're suggesting. Yeah, so I mean, what we do then is once we have these subunits, we can model them, right? We can then assume these are the bipolar cells, this is how the bipolar cells react, and then compare this to models. And I'll get to this in a second, that also relates to Chaim's question.
If you would go from one bipolar cell to another, you would then recover all of these subunits?
That would be our hope, yes. Yeah. So in a thought experiment, yes, that's what happens. But yeah, so we counteract this by the fact that we get, you know, many ganglion cells that we record from, so that we have at least some chance of finding at least cells that overlap and that cells that also where you find a, let's say, a connection, right? But we also find many cases where receptor field overlap, but we don't have a connection. In many examples, we can explain this because they are of very different type, on-cell versus an off-cell, transit versus a sustained cell, but that's not a, you know, that's not the strong argument why the cell should not be connected, right? So we use statistics now to by shuffling to see that statistically often, so significantly often, we find this overlap, but we don't see it in every case and we don't expect it in every case. That makes it complicated. No, that's just experimentally too challenging for us. All right, so, but nonetheless, we take it as a good sign that the subunits that we extract, at least in the salamander, are indeed bipolar cells, and we can then analyze them in that fashion. Okay, very briefly, I want to list what I consider the problematic issues with this analysis at the moment. It's computationally heavy. be nice to make it leaner, faster in a way, to also do more cross checks. We need white noise stimulation, essentially because we're looking at the correlations in the spike eliciting patterns. If there are correlations already to begin with, we will pick up those correlations. So that, and white noise is not always a good stimulus to trigger cells. So it's a constraint that we have. We need a lot of data that's also related to the computation heavy analysis. 10,000 of spikes, below this it doesn't really work. I talked about regularization. That's, for my taste, a little bit too ad hoc. It would be nice to have better cross-checks there. And we also mentioned this. At the moment, we are limited to getting only receptor field centers, both of the ganglion cells as well as the bipolar cells, partly because of our non-negativity constraint. There are some ideas how you could break this up and then maybe also be able to see center surround structure of subunits. But at the moment, we throw this out at the start. Okay. We need a stimulus that has no spatial correlation, because in the method essentially teases out spatial structure, spatial correlations that is related to having a spike. Which pixels, you know, jointly have the same, are both black, let's say, for a spike, and cannot be black and white because otherwise things would cancel out. If we had a natural stimulus, for example, there would be a lot of correlations already in the stimulus, and the method would use these correlations in order to explain essentially the patterns, the correlations in the patterns, not the correlations that are contingent on a spike. So we need to start with something that's uncorrelated.
So one thing is here these subunits, okay, you showed that for this stimulus they kind of map nicely to bipolar cell receptor fields, but in general they include also amacrine cells activity. And so for another stimulus they may change these modules.
Could be.
How should I think about them?
Yeah.
Like, to what extent can I think about them beyond just white noise?
Yeah. So we would say in our case this is an advantage because the spike, the white noise probably doesn't trigger amacrine cells very well. So we can really focus here on the bipolar cells. And once we have that, use that as what I call a scaffold of the circuitry, right? On which you can then add conceptually in your model with other experiments. For example, amacrine cells that make interactions maybe change these subunits. Primarily, I would think that they change the temporal structure of transmission and, you know, provide global inhibition, for example, that is relevant for all bipolar cells. So I don't expect them to change the subunit layout very much, but maybe it will. In order to test this, I mean, the things to do is, as every neurophysiologist does, think of a clever experiment that could is sensitive to amacrine cells, then block these amacrine cells, for example, by inhibition blockers, and see what happens.
And so I don't know on how many ganglion cells you did this, but do you have some idea of what's the spread and how many bipolar cell inputs they get in the mouse?
Yeah, so in the mouse we don't know. We are still starting the analysis there in the salamander. From this analysis, we find that on average something like 10 subunits contribute to a ganglion cell. And that varies probably between cells, cell types. So we see some differences there, but I don't want to make a too strong a claim because also the method works better for some ganglion cells than for others, obviously, because some cells are more nonlinear than others.
Mm-hmm. Or spike-dependent.
Yes. Yeah.
Do some modules always have the same sign, while some other modules have a flipping sign, plus minus? Or
yeah, in principle, that could be the case. For example, we were hoping to see this eventually in on-off cells, that we find some modules that have positive weights and negative weights, depending on whether it's an on or an off bipolar cells. Here, for the data so far, we haven't seen this. And there, it turns out that on average, all the subunits for a ganglion cell have the same weight, and they can then use this average as something like the weight in the neural connectivity sense. So we interpret this then as the stronger the average weight, average over spike of a subunit, the stronger, let's say, the synapse between that bipolar cell and the ganglion cell. And one thing that we've done, for example, analyzed the distance dependence. So we find that the further away from the receptive field center a subunit is, the smaller the average weight in this analysis, averaged over spikes.
The form of the model that we have push, okay, has this great, you know, it's non-linear in the sense that it switches from no activity or negative to having activity or positive, but it still doesn't have a characteristic scale. So in principle, you could imagine making the stimulus twice as large and the more stimulus vary.
Mm-hmm.
But I presume that that's not the case in the retina, which will adapt spatial scales and the like, okay, to different contrasts.
Yeah.
Have you done these in the same preparation at different, do you have any data for how does this fitting change with changing contrast or changing average intensity or something like that?
Yeah, no, we haven't done this. I mean, as I said, these experiments are very time-consuming, right? We take to try to do long recordings, so it's difficult to get many parameter variations for the same retina. You could test this on different retinas, of course, which we haven't done. I mean, the one thing that I should say, I depict this sort of rectifying nonlinearity in the explanations of the model, but the fitting that we do here, or this extraction of subunits, does not depend on the shape of this nonlinearity. It's only important that there is a nonlinearity. So what the threshold is, whether this is something quadratic, something that eventually saturates.
But any other nonlinearity will have an built-in scale, right? In your case, because of the it's a homogeneous function, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you multiply whatever goes before the nonlinearity by lambda,
yeah,
that can solve the other side as one as possible.
Yeah. So that would be then, for example, something that you could see by changing contrast. Yeah, and it's likely that the method depends on contrast. There's an experimental limitation that, you know, because it's a very fine structure, it's a fast stimulus, we try to make the individual pixels per frame as high contrast as possible. And if we go substantially below contrast in that respect, cells just don't respond anymore. The problem is that in the end, in some sense, you get an average over all these pixels and over all these frames, right? So there's a lot of averaging out, and if you still want to drive the cells, really provide input to them, it's best for us to go to the limits in terms of contrast. So we would have to think of other ways of testing this, but I would assume that you're right. I mean, in the end, this will depend on contrast. And that this is really just a strong simplification here. In fact, we know that there's something like a smooth quadratic increase. So the nonlinear becomes much less steep if you close to zero contrast. All right. This is taking much longer than I thought. Maybe I'll therefore go through this a bit more quickly, because it's not so central. It's again meant mostly to maybe trigger some thoughts and also give credit to other people, and show that this is happening in the context of other labs that are also looking at ways of identifying a subunit. So there are alternative approaches. And if people that are familiar with spike-triggered analysis, reverse correlation, and have heard me start with a spike-triggered average, they immediately think, well, if you want multiple filters, the extension is what's called spike-triggered covariance analysis, where the idea is that instead of taking, you know, of these stimuli that generate a spike, just taking the average, taking the covariance matrix and making an eigenvalue analysis and using the eigenvalues as the relevant filters. We've tried this, and not surprisingly, this doesn't work very well. This is an example here for one cell where you get multiple filters and they look like this. So the important point is that they're not localized subunits. It looks more like a spatial Fourier decomposition of the receptive field. And this mostly comes from the fact that you get filters that have to be orthogonal to each other, and that there's no constraint for them being, you know, local, sparse, or non-negative. So you can, you know, any combination of these filters. Sorry? One could add constraints on this, or as Tanya has done in the past, use these filters then and warp the space that they live in to find the subunits, because the subunits should live in the same space that is spanned by these filters. So the second point is that we find that the spectral covariance is more noise sensitive or more data dependent than our method, which is for the same cell, for the same data here, we get these subunits, which look like they're difficult even by, you know, warping out the structure, where we don't even have a well-defined boundary between, you know, relevant filters and non-relevant filters. It's, because this is very high dimensional data, a lot of pixels, spectral covariance just seems to come to limits there. So we abandoned that approach. Another model that I'm also often asked about is the so-called nonlinear input model, NIM, from Dan Butts, which more or less tries to fit an LNLN model. So with two stages of linear and nonlinear processing, and you can think of this first LN as the bipolar cells, the second LN as the pooling of bipolar cells by ganglion cells. They've looked at data from the retina, primarily by stimuli structures by a temporal sequence of stimulation, for example, where on and off inputs are combined to yield responses of on-off cells. So we've tried the algorithm as it's there on the web, and we're not very successful, although I don't think this is necessarily a limitation of the model, but the way that they tuned the parameter fitting of their model, which was tuned more to low-dimensional stimuli, just like, for example, these time series here, where we, here in this case, maybe have 400, 500, 600 pixels. So the fitting method that they have on the web didn't really work there. But I think it may be interesting to explore this model further in the future with other types of fitting methods. Okay, and then very recently from Surya Ganguly and Steve Backus, also related approaches came out. One was trying to, again, fit LNLN models with sophisticated fitting techniques. That's shown here, and they show that when they do this, they are able to get spatial-temporal subunit filters. So this would be a spike triggered average of a ganglion cell, and this would be the extracted subunits, in this case subunits. At the moment, they do this with one spatial dimension, so their stimulus is not individual pixels, but lines over space, so to speak. But at least they get subunit structure here, so that it will also be an interesting comparison in the future. And finally, everyone is going to deep neural networks, convolutional neural networks, also the retina field, and again, Surya Ganguly, Steve Backus have joined forces here to fit retinal data with a deep neural network as structured here, and they find out that in the first layer of this network, they also get localized subunits, which they are careful enough to say these have some resemblance with bipolar cells, although it's not so clear whether they are actually matched bipolar cells. Okay. Interestingly, or for us, an interesting connection is to models in primary visual cortex, where also very similar models are being explored, for example, by Iris Simoncelli, convolutional subunit models where individual filters are then combined in order to explain responses, for example, of complex cells in V1. So similar methods could apply there. And probably others that I'm forgetting here. Okay, and I'm slowly approaching the end. So what can we do now with these subunits? For example, can we use them to build models of ganglion cells? And the bench line for us is then always this linear nonlinear model, where spatial integration is just captured by the receptor field as a linear filter, and then you have a nonlinearity that's optimized in order to model the firing rate, and then we contrast this against our subunit model where we have multiple spatial filters. They are combined after their signals go through such a rectifying nonlinearity, which we use here ad hoc. We don't optimize this, we just plug it in knowing that it's not going to be the best option, but for simplicity, and then also we predict the firing rate. Then we use our test data, so this is a white noise sequence that is repeated many times, which we don't use for getting the subunits, but which we can then use, for example, to look at responses. Here, many trials, you see reliable responses. And we see that the LN model, again, not surprisingly, doesn't capture this very much, too much spatial structure here. And the subunit model at least does better. Right? You see that some of these events here are also now captured here, although it's not as precise as the real data, primarily because we didn't include any feedback mechanism here, anything that would sharpen the responses in time. So we're not too concerned about the fact that we don't match the temporal resolution. So we get improvements for most of the cells that we record from in terms of variance explained when we compare the subunit model with our straw man benchmark, the LN model.
Is it sufficient improvements to
that's sufficient or necessary. Yeah, I mean, it's a matter of taste, right? So we obviously we get some percentage, but not even half the thing that we are missing yet. But again, most of that, what we are missing is here contained in the temple structure, and we'll have to approach this to other means. So it will be one component of probably several others that we need to get to a really satisfactory model. Sorry? Absolutely, the LN model can also be improved, has improved by other methods. And the interesting thing will be combining these different approaches. But I think this will be at least one of the relevant improvements that we can add.
Sam, is there, maybe this is what you're getting at, is there an iterative sense? I mean, it looks like on every trial, the subunit model, quote unquote, picks out certain frames that were not picked out in the raw data. And is there a way then to go back to the stimulus frames? And maybe you're sort of picking up false features and modify the subunit filters accordingly?
That could be a way. I mean, at least going back now to the original data and see where the model failed or where, you know, give spurious responses that are not there. Is likely helpful in understanding what we are missing, yes, but we haven't done this.
So again, what I see in the LM model and the subunit model is that in the regions in which the data has these huge gaps, there's a considerable amount of activity that was shown sparsely over the top there. Mm-hmm.
Here, so we have activity here, right? Where the data, the neuron is really absolutely silent. Absolutely, yes. Yeah, I mean, for us, we see it in the same, a little bit in the same fashion as why, for example, when the neuron actually fires, it fires so much more precisely, both in time as well as in reliability than any of the models that we have at the moment. Again, we believe that a lot of this comes from temporal dynamics in the actual cell, feedback mechanisms, adaptation mechanisms on fast timescales that shape the responses that we just haven't looked at here. But that will be very helpful for, you know, putting things together for a model that contains both spatial substructure as well as temporal nonlinearities or feedback mechanisms that get these responses in a better shape, literally. Absolutely. But I don't have a good answer at the moment. Okay, yes.
How do you know that the difference from data and subunit model is by feedback? So for example, if you have a deep network, like convolutional network, in principle, the complex model can capture the relationship.
Yeah, that could be, yeah. I mean, my assumption that it comes from feedback is because other studies that have not looked at subunits have looked at effects of feedback, for example, things like refractory period and fast adaptation, and have seen that this is way very easily and well gets you much closer to the precision of actual data. And because of the success of those models, and because we know that these mechanisms are there in the ganglion cell, this makes this, I think, a strong hypothesis that this is where it comes from. Maybe you can capture this with a deep neural network, but then again, you don't know what the real mechanism is behind this.
Well, even if you do capture it by a deep neural network, it's not that aspect isn't temporal. So that it would rule out any temporal processing.
Yes.
So it would be blind to any actual temporal process.
Exactly, yeah.
Right. These deep networks, if I understand, they have some temporal filter at the beginning, which you tune.
I mean, there are different versions of this.
You could make a deep recurring network or something.
So there are temporal filters, and maybe the temporal filters would be adjusted in such a way that you may be able to capture this.
Absolutely.
Maybe the structure would not be enough. I can capture this. The deep neural networks, I think they do much better even than, I mean, obviously also than, obviously than the LM model, but even compared to the subunit model.
They do much better than
I think so. I mean, we haven't tested this on this data here, but, you know, there's a preprint, right? But from what I read in the preprint, they do quite well in terms of, you know, getting to limits imposed by the variability of the responses, of the measured responses.
Did you try other stimuli to see how this model works?
Sorry, did I?
Did you try other kinds of stimuli?
Yes, if I can get to the next slide, I'll show you one example. If you want to ask a question. At the moment, yes.
But there's also this W matrix, which has some structure.
Yes.
It's anticorrelated with the image. And I don't see how the W matrix, if it's anticorrelated with the image, how we wouldn't capture the matrix.
Oh, we could capture, so to speak, subunits of the opposite sides. It's just that the biological data doesn't give us that. If we put it into a model, it extracts it just fine. But the data that we have recorded so far seems to not have that. Okay, so just one other example is natural images. In this case, we use just flashed images to compare our models in order to get away from these temporal structures that we haven't captured well, and then compare how well our subunit model does with our LN model. It gives a systematic improvement, again, for us, worth the effort, for others, maybe not, so it's not that substantial. The primary reason for this being that for just generic natural stimuli, you have a lot of correlations, so for many images, it doesn't matter whether there are subunits or not. If you see just a homogeneous blue sky, right, subunit position doesn't matter.
This is much better than the previous.
You would say this is better than this one here?
No, the numbers are, you mean both of them are better.
Yeah, so the numbers are higher. The numbers are higher because we threw away.
This is correlation.
Sorry, this is correlation. This is. Yeah, exactly, yeah. Thank you, yeah, yeah. So here, I mean, we do this for several other reasons that we here analyze how well the responses predict the sequence of images, which get the highest firing rate, which the lowest firing rate, because that allows us to not depend on time, nor on these non-linearities here that, you know, also additional parameters. So, because it just tells us how strongly either the subunit model is activated or the actual model is activated. Obviously, we will want and need to go much further in trying to predict actual responses here. Okay, but anyway, we think that the subunit models go in the right direction. Okay, now going from individual cells to populations, just to show you as a, you know, where we want to go in the future, this is an example where we recorded many cells that we classified as a single type here, so-called fast-off ganglion cells in the salamander retina through some cluster analysis. And then we can do this analysis for all of these cells, taking quite some time, and get the subunits. And then we believe we can look at an entire population of bipolar cells in the presynaptic layer, getting us to this early pictures of, let's say, virtually imaging this presynaptic layer. And now we can start analyzing overlaps, which we often find is the case. If receptor fields overlap, then also the subunits overlap. And we can go one step further and look at different types of cells. And here this would be one example out of this population of a fast-off cell and its subunits. And here's another cell that we recorded in the same recording, which is a direction-selective cell, and then asked how do these subunits relate to each other. And we see that for these particular types of cells, they overlap quite nicely in many examples, not always exactly, but statistically often enough for us now to claim or hypothesize that in the salamander, fast-off cells and direction-selective cells get input from the same set of presynaptic bipolar cells.
And can you sort these bipolars into subtypes based on their receptive field size?
Yes, we...
I don't know, I mean, these are more of the Gaussian, but...
We could, yeah. We haven't done this primarily because, I mean, this is a long analysis that comes out with this result, so there's a little bit of variation there. So we don't find that the difference in the sizes of bipolar cells are very telling of types. What we try to do now is go via this connectivity and say there are those bipolar cells that connect to fast-off cells, and there are those bipolar cells that connect to slow-off cells. of cells. And if they don't overlap as they do here for these particular types, they are likely of different types. And this we may be able to use as a way to classifying the reconstructed bipolar cells into types. Assuming here, if we find something like a tiling here, that it's a single type of bipolar cell that is responsible for the responses, for example, in these fast off cells, and not two types of bipolar cells.
Do bipolar cells differ mainly by their temporal filter?
Primarily, yes.
And the temporal filter that you get gives you an indication of bipolar cells that it's
yes and no, probably more no than yes. So one thing that we can do is functionally see whether things are consistent with bipolar, with these subunits having homogeneous temporal filters by, again, now that we have the subunits, we can, so to speak, use the activation of those subunits, build, for example, an LN model or get a temporal filter of how the activation of this spatial structure relates in time to giving us responses. And this gives us temporal filters for individual subunits, and we find that they match typically for subunits that come from the same cell. We don't think, though, that these are really the temporal filters of the bipolar cells, but more the temporal structure of the inputs that come from these bipolar cells after being modified by amacrine cells, by synaptic properties, so it's more of an effective filter. Okay. Summary, I'm finished. So I think in the retina, as well as in other fields, we need to go beyond these linear receptor fields to capture their functions. And we see this most strongly by the discrepancy between the simple LN model and data when we try to describe responses to natural stimuli. And one way that we propose to go along this way is to use this method that I've introduced, STNMF, based on non-negative matrix factorization, to extract the non-linear subunits inside receptor fields of ganglion cells. We think that, at least in the salamander retina, they correspond to indeed individual bipolar cells because we see this nice match with receptor field of bipolar cells. And having these subunits helps us predict responses and get better models of subunits, not going all the way, but I think a critical step. And finally, we can use it now as a tool also to look into circuit structure, what is the connectivity between bipolar cells and ganglion cells. And then I want to end by thanking the people involved in this work, my group at the Medical Center Göttingen, and also involved in this subunit identification were our collaborators from Italy, Stefano Panzeri and Arno Ongen, who introduced us to the non-negative matrix factorization. And the work that I've shown you primarily comes from a former postdoc of mine, John Liu, who developed the non-negative matrix factorization. Helene Schreier did these difficult bipolar cell recordings in combination with ganglion cells. She's currently a postdoc in the lab. Vidya Krishnamurthy, a former postdoc in the lab now in Newcastle, did these saccade stimulation of the retina and finding these cells that are sensitive to image recurrence. And finally, Fernando Rosenbitt, a postdoc in the lab, does all the functional clustering, identifying different cells, for example, the fast off cells that I've shown you. And with this, I thank you for your attention and for all the questions. Yes, actually we have done this partly, and in some cases it works well, and in some cases we find that reducing ourselves to half the data already generates, let's say, so much noise or takes away too much data that we lose individual subunits. We don't recover them.
You don't lose, you say you get the same.
In, let's say, in many cases, yeah. Yeah, so I mean, this depends a little bit on some technical details. So what we attempt here is we attempt to rank the images. So we have 300 images, and one gave the highest average response, another one the second highest response, and sometimes the differences in these responses is quite subtle, right? Sometimes they are identically zero, for example, and sometimes they are on average 0.1 spike more in for one image than in the other image. And this is what we try to measure here or relate to. And yeah, sometimes that seems to be too difficult. So technically, it's the rank correlation between the model prediction and the measured responses.
But if you had sort of a model that is perfectly matched to the retina, then the correlation you would get would be 1 for the...
Yeah, apart from the fact that sometimes, you know, this is also experimental data that comes with noise. Maybe we have 10 repeats per image, right? So it may be that the experimental variability, you know, gives us in some sense the wrong order of the image, if the right order would be the one that we got with infinite data, right? So there's some...
And could it be that also there's something maybe before it sees the image, like some initial condition of the system that would cause problems?
Yeah, that as well. I mean, again, we have an experimental system here, so things are, you know, time-dependent, history-dependent, fatigue-dependent. So the image come in a sequence. We try to make the gap between images long enough that the previous image doesn't affect the response, but of course, you know, it's never long enough to be absolutely correct. And it's also a compromise that we have to get through with our experiments before the retina dies. So there's also some noise that comes from these experimental factors.
But I thought you repeated at 30 hertz, no?
30 hertz was the white noise stimulus. The natural images, I think, are presented at 1 hertz. So 200 millisecond image, 800 millisecond gray period, and then the next image.
Why not show them
only? Why not show them in sequence? I think that's a good suggestion, and that's what we want to do. The reason to go here to flashed images, first of all, would be that that essentially, for the spatial analysis or analysis of spatial structure, we want to get rid of as much temporal dynamics as possible to focus on that. Because
you're still getting it back.
Sorry?
You're still getting it back for adaptation.
Yeah, but it's a much milder fashion. So the problem with adaptation in natural images is, I mean, for white noise, things are still okay, right? Because you're essentially stationary. But for natural images, right, you have a 1 second where things are darker than in the next second. You have light adaptation on many timescales, and including everything is a big challenge. I mean, we want to go there, but for a first step, it was easier to kick out time.